So could you just start by giving me your name and saying what your position is?
Yes, I'm Richard Fletcher, and I'm Senior Research Fellow and Leader of the Research Team at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at the University of Oxford.
Okay, thanks very much. And can you just, we don't have time for your entire life story, but could you just give me a rough summary of how you got to where you are now and how you became interested in the field of research that you're interested in?
So I originally studied computer science at university, and then after that I did a master's degree in science, technology, medicine and society, then a PhD in sociology, and after that I was looking for research opportunities, and I found one studying journalism at City University in London, and that project was looking at how it would be possible to build a tool that could be used by journalists and the public in order to verify information that they found on social media. And this led to a sort of follow-up position here at the Reuters Institute, and that was in 2015, and I've been here ever since. And here we research journalism, how people get news and information across different countries, and of course that fed into some of the work we did on coronavirus starting in 2020.
Mm. Yeah, we'll move on to that. But I'm quite interested in the transition you made from being a computer scientist to being somebody who's, I suppose, broadly speaking, in the social sciences.
Yes. It wasn't planned. It was something that worked out quite well. I worked on projects which involved data when I was studying computing science. And although data wasn't really a sort of seen as important as it is now, you know, in the intervening time, the social sciences became more sort of data oriented, I think, and that sort of the skills working with data, and programming became useful in sort of social research in ways that I didn't anticipate, but it's worked out reasonably well.
Mm-hmm. And when you went to study journalism, had you had any thoughts of actually becoming a journalist yourself at that point, or were you always interested in studying it as a phenomenon?
No, never wanted to be a journalist. Always interested in journalism and the news media, but not something I'd wanted to work actively in. I was just interested in being a researcher and understanding sort of society and people better. And people's relationship with the news media and how they get news and information has always been interesting to me.
And that's something that's massively changed over the last, I don't know where you want to start, but certainly over the last 30 years, I would say.
Yes, one of the projects, the ongoing projects that we have here at the Institute is called the Digital News Report. Mm-hmm. And that started in 2012, and it was one of the first projects that really tried to look at how people got news and information across multiple countries. People had done this in specific countries, but they hadn't compared it that often. So that started before I was here, but it's still going. It's based on an annual survey now in about 40 different countries of how people get news and information. And since 2012, when we started, up till this year, we've seen huge change. So in particular, the rise of social media as a source of information, the decline of traditional forms of news media, like print and to a certain extent television, and the growth of smartphones in particular as a way for people to connect to the internet and then access the news.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, is it possible to put figures on the size of that change?
Yes, roughly. From memory, it's so in 2013, in many countries, only about a quarter of people said that they regularly access news and information on their smartphone, compared to around 70% in some countries now. So it's a huge change, and it's something that you know, even if you study this year on year, you can see sort of large increases. And this is why we do the project every year rather than every 5 years, which is what a lot of, you know, sort of longitudinal studies do. Just because the rate of change has been so dramatic in some areas. And of course this varies across countries. Some countries haven't changed as much as others, but it's, you know, that's what makes it interesting, and that's what you know, justifies the inclusion of lots of different countries in the study.
Mm-hmm. And that's presumably also involved a proliferation of providers, from having you know, a relatively small number of recognised news organisations within each country, to having a number of sources that are available by the internet.
That's right. There's been a huge growth in information supply, but at the same time, the sort of demand, you know, sort of within each person hasn't really changed a huge amount. So there's much more choice than there was. And of course, this sort of predates the internet to a certain extent, when with the growth of cable television and so on. But the internet has made that more pronounced. Although it's still true that the sort of traditional news organisations in this country, the BBC, the Guardian, the Mail, and so on, are still the most widely used sources of news. There are many more outlets in the so-called long tail, meaning that if people are aware of them, they can access them online, and this has added sort of huge diversity to people's news and information repertoires in some cases.
Mm. And does that also mean that there's been a fragmentation on the demand side, that people, you know, fall into groups that access their news from a particular source and would never look at another source? Is there any evidence of an increased fragmentation like that?
I mean, not really, because I think it's still the case that for most people, the large traditional news brands are still the most widely used, and that accounts for a huge amount of the total news use. So if there's fragmentation, it's on a smaller scale, and it's among sort of smaller groups in society who perhaps have turned away from these large news sources and are accessing alternative sources. But even for many of these people, they're still coming back to, for example, the BBC and the Mail and the Guardian and so on, as their sort of reference point. So it's only a very, very small part of the population that have abandoned the sort of mainstream news sources entirely.
Mm. Can you just tell me a little bit more about how the digital news survey works? Sorry, I may have used that term slightly wrongly. Digital news report works. How do you collect the data?
So the data we collect each year through an online survey, which is administered by the polling company YouGov, but the questionnaire is designed by us and our team at the Institute. We go into the field in January and February each year, and then that gives us enough time to analyse the data ready for publication in the summer, usually in the middle of June.
Mm-hmm.
But it's based on an online survey. We also supplement it with qualitative research, not in as many countries, so we typically run focus groups or interview sessions in a handful of countries that we can use to sort of better understand some of the data we get from the survey.
And YouGov makes a selection of, you know, targets, a representative sample.
That's right, yeah. The samples are, obviously it's an online survey, so we can't reach anyone who doesn't have access to the internet, but in many of the countries we study, the internet penetration is very high. And we use quota sampling, so YouGov ensure that we have the right number of men, women, and people in certain age groups, etc., that matches the national population.
Mm. And what kind of questions are you asking?
So some of these are quite fundamental questions. So what sources of news people are using, how often they're using them. But also we look at people's attitudes towards the news, whether they trust it, whether they think they're avoiding the news more than they used to. And things like that. So it's a mixture of behaviour and attitudes. About two-thirds of the survey we keep the same every year because we want to track developments over time, and the remaining third is devoted to some new issues that have emerged that we want to get people's opinion on.
So, finally, turning to coronavirus, just from a personal point of view, can you remember how you first came to hear about it and realise that it was something that was going to be relevant to your research?
I can't remember the exact dates, but I certainly remember hearing about it as something that was still quite far away in January 2020, discussing it with friends and so on. And I also, you know, on Twitter, you would see experts, sort of epidemiologists, sort of speculating, but also I remember some being quite concerned. And I think that was probably the very first moment that I thought, you know, this could be something that's very serious. And then I think when it really dawned on me that this was going to have a large impact on daily life, when European countries started going into lockdown, and then at that point it felt almost inevitable that the UK would follow at some point.
What did you see? Did you see that as an opportunity to dedicate part of your data gathering, your research, to focus on how that was going to impact on consumption of news and trust in news and so on?
Well, I'm biased, and I always think that sort of communication is always important for any sort of political event, and I think particularly so during a crisis. And I did remember thinking that maybe we could do some research that would help. I know that the particularly in the UK, we have a good sense of where sort of research like the research that we do might come from. And we thought we were quite well placed to be able to make a contribution, because we thought we could do something that was timely, because we imagined the situation would change very quickly, and we thought maybe we were agile enough to be able to sort of generate some reliable data that could feed into people's understanding.
So what did you do? I mean, did you need to raise funding in order to get something started, or were you able to simply adapt what you were already doing?
It's a bit of both. So one of the first things we did was this was in April 2020, was a six-country survey of news use, but specifically on coronavirus news use. And the funding from that came from an existing project that was ongoing, the Misinformation Science and Media Project, which was funded by the Oxford Martin School. We were able to use some of the funding to work on this project. Simultaneously, I think we also sought funding from the Nuffield Foundation for a project specifically looking at the UK over time. So we proposed a 10-wave survey. So starting with a sort of large panel of respondents, and then coming back to them every 2 weeks for several months. And for that, we bid for funding from the Nuffield Foundation, and we got that. So we were able to start that in April as well.
So let's just take those two projects. So obviously misinformation has been an issue throughout the pandemic, but it was an issue before in a variety of other political and social areas. So what were the findings of that first study?
The first study, the six-country study, was the primary purpose, I think, was to look at the differences between countries, and we deliberately selected countries that were at different stages. So we had countries from Asia-Pacific, where the pandemic had been sort of going on for a little bit longer. We had European countries which were just going into lockdown, but we also had Latin American countries where really the pandemic hadn't really arrived to the same extent there. So that was the point of comparison. One of the things we found, despite those differences, was a very large increase in self-reported news use. So people were saying they're accessing news a lot more. And also, at the same time, we also noticed an increase in people's trust in the news. And what we call this a rally around the news effect, which borrows a term from political science, the rally around the flag effect, which is where in a crisis, people's support for their leaders tends to go up. I guess because people are concerned and worried about the future, and they have little choice but to sort of put a bit more trust in those in charge. And we saw a similar effect across all countries, because even though the pandemic hadn't arrived, it was still a global news event, and people were aware of it.
So that's interesting that they were more trustworthy, more trusting in
Yeah, that was, I mean, we I suppose we'd expected news use to go up. That wasn't a huge surprise, but we weren't quite prepared for the increase in trust. Just to keep in mind that since 2015, when we've been tracking trust in the news, it's been an almost consistent sort of decline in many countries. So it was very unusual to see trust go up in that way.
Mm. But you think it was the reason was the fact that there was this global crisis?
We think so. I mean, later on, when we asked similar questions in the digital news report, which is of course across you know, over 40 different countries, we saw an increase in trust, even though it was a bit later, in almost all of those, and we thought that there was only really one sort of global event big enough in order to create that sort of parallel rise everywhere. And of course, you know, the next question is what's actually really going on, and that's where we're not so sure. But my thinking is that coronavirus squeezed out a lot of the sort of political news and replaced it with something that was a bit less partisan, a bit less divisive. And when you ask people why they don't trust the news, they often mention bias and this kind of thing. And I think there was just less room for that not in every country, of course, but in many countries there was less of that. And I think that sort of filtered through to people's attitudes.
Mm-hmm. And presumably there was just a hunger for information. I'm thinking particularly of things like, I don't know if this was part of your six-country study, but in the UK there were daily briefings with the Prime Minister and the Chief Scientific and Medical Advisors. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I wouldn't normally watch TV at that kind of time of day, but a lot of people felt that knowing what had been said at those briefings was an important part of their day.
That's right. One of the other things that we saw early on was not just an increase in news organisations as a source of information about coronavirus, but other sources as well. So politicians, scientists were much more prominent than they would normally be, especially scientists who, as you mentioned, were part of the daily briefings in the UK and were used as a source of information much more widely than they would be at normal times.
And I mean, I guess it's relatively new that the general public have had access to things like the Johns Hopkins data that was published at regular intervals and Our World in Data, and some of these other online data sources that simply presented the figures, which I suppose previously you would have needed to be mediated through some kind of journalistic.
That's right. Yes, Ofcom. I think in their study they were doing a study that was quite similar to ours in the UK, and I think it's still ongoing. We're tracking that as well. The use of certain sort of dashboards tracking cases and deaths and so on. And in their data, these are quite widely used, and I think it became part of some people, not everyone, of course, but some people's sort of daily sort of media habits is sort of checking in with these sources.
Mm-hmm. So turning to your UK study, that just ran for eight months. Is that right?
It was yes. It ran from end of April to end of August in terms of data collection, and then we were still publishing the results of that, you know, up until October, but the field work was April to August.
Mm. And what were the main questions you were asking in that study?
It was similar to those that we'd asked in the six-country study, but the strength in this case was collecting data from the same people over time, so we could really sort of see how people's attitudes and behaviours were changing. And one of the things we saw fairly early on in the project was that the sort of peak of news use and also trust was really in April, the end of April and then the beginning of May, and the decline after that was quite sharp. And going and sort of alongside that, you could also see people's behaviour changing, and we were going into the summer at this point, so people were, following describing how they were following the sort of guided, slightly sort of less sort of religiously than they had been. You know, still the majority of are following the guidance, you know, very closely. But
so that was one of the questions that you asked was how.
Yeah, we asked that, and And I think not just our study, this was something that, that others were tracking as well. And I think one of the sort of defining themes was the sort of high degree of public sort of willingness to follow the rules. And also one of the things that we noticed, we asked people questions about, which really we were designed to tap their knowledge of coronavirus, so how much they knew about the virus, the rules surrounding it. And we found, I mean, we didn't necessarily have anything to directly compare it to, but what I thought were very high levels of sort of awareness and knowledge of the virus, and also the what people needed to do in order to stay safe from it.
So those were that peak and decline in trust, and the high level of knowledge were two of the findings from that. Were there other?
Yes, so, I mean, one of the as part of this project, we published the results of each survey, you know, shortly after, so at 2 week intervals, we published a sort of what we called a fact sheet, which had the numbers in. But we also did a couple of some longer reports that tried to sort of bring together some of the findings from the 10 weeks. And the first of those looked at what we called inequalities in news and information use. So at the beginning of the pandemic, when the news use was at its highest, then really there were very small differences between demographic groups in terms of how much news and information they were getting, because it, sort of everyone was getting news at that point. So it had papered over some of the long-standing inequalities in news use that we know exist. So for example, younger people tend to consume less news, women tend to consume less news, people with lower levels of formal education consume less news, and so on. But at this point, in the beginning of the pandemic in the UK, those gaps had temporarily disappeared, and what we saw over time was that their reemergence, although news use was still a lot higher even during the summer than it would be in normal times, it was that those gaps reemerged. And of course, you know, because we think that the people's news and information use is very important for how they behave, how much they know during the crisis, that was a cause for concern. And then in later on, we tried to come up with a concept that sort of captured this, which we called the infodemically vulnerable. And this was the group that consumes almost no news and information about coronavirus, and also has very low trust or no trust in that information, even if they were to come across it. And partly because of the inequalities that had emerged during the pandemic, but also because we also saw a rise in news avoidance, so people stepping back from the news because they think there's too much of it, or it's having a negative effect on their well-being. We saw the size of the infodemically vulnerable group grow over time slightly, and of course this can be linked to sort of lower levels of knowledge, less willingness to follow the rules, and so on.
So how big did that group get?
It was still quite small. So when we first started to measure it, I think it was about 5%. And by the end of the our field work, I think it had reached 15%, roughly 15%. So it's not a huge group within society, but the fact that it was growing was still a concern, I think.
Yes, yes. So that study finished before the vaccination program started?
Yes, it did, yes. We thought about continuing it, but that would have been quite complicated because we start off with a panel of a certain size, and people drop out over time, and eventually, you know, because you need to keep talking to the same people over time, you end up with a group that's too small really to make any sort of meaningful claims about the population. So the project had finished, yes, in a few months before the vaccination program started. Mm-hmm. But we were still interested in attitudes towards vaccines, because of course they were still talked about at the time, and we did have some data on people's sort of hypothetical willingness to get a vaccine.
And have you been able to ask questions relevant to the pandemic in your bigger Digi News survey?
Yes, I mean we also the 6-country study that we conducted in April 2020, we were able to repeat in 2021.
Oh, right.
with 8 countries this time, and we asked many of the same questions, so we could see sort of a yearly change. And by that point, we were able to include questions on vaccination, because people, you know, the program had started in some countries, and also people were much better informed. It was less hypothetical than it was, so we were able to include some of those. And also, yes, in the digital news report, we had some questions on coronavirus as well, but normally a bit broader than the questions that we'd had in the coronavirus sort of focus studies.
Mm-hmm. And did you see much change between 2020 and 2021 in the kinds of things that you were seeing?
Yes, it's difficult to sort of capture it in one sentence, but I think...
You'll use as many sentences as you need.
But essentially, I mean, it's not really a surprise, but we saw in the data that we were looking at over time, we did see a year later that people were using far less news on coronavirus. That's perhaps not a surprise. But we did also see declines in trust. So not just among news organisations, but also most other sources of information about the crisis. So governments, politicians, sort of international health organisations, scientists. In some cases, these declines weren't huge, but it was certainly there was certainly evidence of it. And I think by that point, even though these scientists in particular were very highly trusted, I think perhaps there was a small part of the population that had perhaps sort of picked up on the sort of natural uncertainty that goes with a situation like this, and then perhaps lost trust after, you know, sort of mistakes were made and so on, but still the most trusted source of information in almost every country. And as we as I mentioned, we also asked questions on vaccines, and in particular we're interested in people's belief in misinformation about vaccines. And there the picture is quite encouraging. We found relatively low levels of belief in some of the most widely disseminated sort of false claims about vaccines.
The Bill Gates is trying to put a
robot
into your
that kind of thing, but also about some of the sort of the health risks.
Yes.
And so on, and we found relatively low levels of belief in that, which was encouraging. And I think that broadly tallies with the data on uptake, and also data not from us but from other sources about vaccine hesitancy sort of decreasing quite a lot over time, as the vaccine program sort of, you know, had demonstrably was working. So I think that it aligned with that as well.
Mm-hmm. So what? Sorry.
Yes. No, thanks.
Have a brief pause. Do you drink your coffee?
No, it's still probably a bit hot.
So you've mentioned that other organisations have been doing similar research.
Mm.
Has your research become more collaborative as a result of the pandemic? Has it prompted you to form wider links with other organisations, or had you always been working in that kind of way?
I think many of the links that we already had we used during the coronavirus research. So, for example, on the digital news report, where we were studying lots of different countries, you know, we don't claim to be able to understand all of those countries, you know, in as much detail as people on the ground can. So we have a network of partners in those countries who help us understand some of the data and also formulate the questions, and we were able to draw on that network when we were looking at coronavirus as well. The other organisations that were useful in the coronavirus research are fact checkers. We drew a lot on their work. And I've also mentioned Ofcom already, who do an enormous amount of media research in the UK, and their sort of their work, which they were also kind of publishing in real time, like we were trying to do, helped inform what we were doing as well. And of course, there were a handful of other projects doing similar things. So the Winton Centre for Risk at the University of Cambridge, they were looking at similar things, not with a focus on the media, but certainly with a focus on public attitudes towards coronavirus. So I think those were the main sort of projects and the main organisations that we were not collaborating with directly, but sort of communicating with and looking at their work.
Mm-hmm. And who would you say are the main consumers of your research? You said at the start you wanted to do something to help.
Mm.
Who is using the kind of data that you're generating?
We see our main audience as a mixture of journalists and others that work for news organisations, policymakers, commentators and observers who are interested in developments in news and the media. So an example of that might be people who write about tech, or perhaps even work for big tech companies, and also academics. The reports that we publish, I think, are, we hope that academics read them, but they're mainly designed and written in a way that people who don't have sort of academic social science expertise can understand. And we have, you know, we publish academic articles as well for the academic audience, but I think we see it quite broadly, and I think we certainly aim to act as a bridge between research that is conducted to academic standards and policymakers, journalists, etc.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think your findings have influenced policy?
Well, we particularly during the beginning of the UK project, we had a lot of media coverage that was picked up by politicians during Prime Minister's Questions, for example. We were mentioned in one of those, and also I gave evidence to an inquiry by the Public Affairs and something committee. I'll have to check on that. It was doing an inquiry into the use of data during the pandemic, and I gave evidence of that based on our research in the UK.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose because I'm still thinking about this article I read about suggesting that the pandemic will end when people stop looking at dashboards. Can people have too much data, too much information?
I mean, I think the it's possible, and particularly when there's so much uncertainty like there was at the beginning of the pandemic, and to a certain extent there is now as well, but certainly at the beginning of the pandemic, there's a huge amount of uncertainty, and there was a lot of data. So there was data coming from multiple countries on cases, all of which were being measured in a slightly different way. Also, you know, hospitalizations, etc. And it was easy at that point to use that data and arrive at a misleading conclusion. Even with, you know, people with the best will in the world, and also sort of, you know, sometimes experts in the topic. With a new situation, I think it was very difficult. And you know, if experts are finding it difficult and there's uncertainty involved, then the public will also likely sort of struggle with it as well. Whether that means there was too much information, I don't know, but I can certainly see the risk. And of course, this is in part where the sort of infodemic term comes from,
yeah,
and why the WHO started to use it. And I think there was some instances of that, as I said, but there's an equally suppressing problem in not so much in the UK, but in other in some other countries where there's a real lack of data and a lack of sort of transparency around the data that does exist, and of course that's a serious problem as well.
Mm-hmm. So turning more personally, so how did the first lockdown impact on what you were able to do?
Well, I certainly remember at the beginning of the pandemic when the UK started, well, not the beginning, but when the UK went into lockdown, a huge amount of uncertainty around how it would work, whether sort of, you know, sort of big parts of society might cease to function. That was certainly a concern, and I know people around me as well were thinking along similar lines. And I think it's easy to forget how sort of real some of those risks felt right at the beginning. In terms of working, that part of it was relatively straightforward, just because most people on the research team of the institute, they're used to working from home. Mm. You know, in their previous jobs, they perhaps worked from home a little bit as well. Social scientists can do quite a lot with just their laptop. Mm. So in one sense, a lot could carry on as normal. Other things became almost impossible. So face-to-face sort of qualitative research wasn't an option. We had to move online, and we did that in our research, not just on the digital news report, but on a parallel project called the Trust in News project, where we wanted to do face-to-face interviews and just weren't able to do them. So there are some sort of practical aspects of research that became much harder. But day-to-day work, I was quite proud of the people I worked with who were able to adapt to using, you know, video conferencing software, doing everything by email, accessing, you know, the university systems remotely. And it wasn't easy, but it was that wasn't the most sort of challenging part, I don't think.
Mm. What was the most challenging part?
Well, everything to do with the sort of social interactions that you miss, that I really believe that they're important when it comes to generating ideas for research, you know, brainstorming sessions to come up with questions to include in the survey, things like this, which just don't really work well online. I think just that combined with the sort of challenges of working from home, which personally I'm relatively fortunate, but for those who had children doing homeschooling, you know, perhaps sort of sharing a sort of small flat with their partner who's working there as well, that kind of thing. And there are, of course, people on our team who are in that situation, so I think they would have certainly found that difficult.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any positive outcomes? I mean, we've all got extremely familiar with working remotely now, and I mean, sometimes it is just more convenient. Do you think that's something that's going to stay part of your the package of things that guide how you work in the future?
Yes, I think people are different, and some people struggle with the idea of working from home, and for others it's really a kind of blessing. I mean, you know, people often don't like commuting. They perhaps sort of don't sort of feel like they sort of thrive in an office environment, and prefer to work at a slightly different pace remotely, and that's some of the feedback that we've got, not necessarily at the institute, but in the sort of the DPIR more widely. Mm. So I think it suits a lot of people, and I think it makes sense therefore to think about how that sort of hybrid working can carry on. Mm.
And what I think about travel, because I mean, you do a lot of your work as an international.
Yeah.
Were you doing much traveling before, or did you just?
Yes.
Yeah.
When we're covering lots of different countries, eventually, you know, there are people in those countries who want to hear what you found, because, you know, we can't put it all the data from, you know, a 46 country study into a report. So there's lots that isn't included, and you know, you can do a kind of deep dive on certain countries, and people are interested in that. But also, you know, kind of international organisations like the European Parliament, UNESCO, etc. They, you know, they have they're based outside of the UK. So there was travel there to do events there, and sort of meeting with colleagues often outside of academia. There was, yeah, we did a lot of that before the and still do, of course, but that's the kind of thing that can be done remotely. And I think it remains to be seen whether that will go back to sort of in-person events, but I think it's increasingly, you know, it's something that can be done online, I think.
Mm. I mean, I suppose with the sort of growing awareness that climate change pressures suggest that travel should be minimised.
Yes, exactly, yes. I think there's good arguments there, and also, you know, now we have a kind of a sort of proof of concept that this kind of thing can be done online. Yes. Then that might make it easier to change habits.
Mm-hmm. And what about your working hours? Did you stay much the same, or were you working harder than you had before?
The UK project, which was on a kind of 2-week cycle, mm-hmm. that was it sounds like that should be manageable, and we thought it would be, but it was quite relentless. As soon as we finished one, writing up the results from one sort of wave of the survey, we immediately had to start on the next one, and
How many of you were working on that?
There were four of us. So myself, Rasmus Nielsen, who's the director of the institute, a former colleague called Antonis Kalogaropoulos, who's at the University of Liverpool, and Felix Simon, who is doing a PhD at the Oxford Internet Institute. Mm. Those are the four of us on the team. Of course, you know, we have people working on the sort of publications within the institute as well, but that was on the research side.
And the data, were people sent questionnaires, or were you actually emailing them or ringing them up or whatever together?
So again, YouGov were administering
it,
we designed the questionnaire, and they send it out to their panel and then deliver the results back. Mm-hmm. But to do it every 2 weeks was, and then sort of, you know, before going into the field for the next survey, we wanted to publish the results, and so we did that in the form of what we call fact sheets, yeah. Which were sort of kind of eight page summaries of the data. And it was I'd be lying if I said it, but that was a 9-to-5 job. But other than that, I think it's been quite similar, and I've, you know, just spent the time that I would have spent in the office at home, and then stopping at a certain point. But I, you know, often you hear about other colleagues, not necessarily here, but sort of in the wider university, whose working patterns have changed a bit because there's less of a barrier between sort of work and home.
And do you have any involvement in teaching?
No, okay. I don't.
We didn't discuss that. It's not something that you've done. But were you involved in any discussions about your department's safety regime and the measures that were brought in, both for, you know, I mean, presumably to begin with, it was just don't come in.
No, not at the department level, mm. but we have our own sort of policies for this building, which I've been involved in just some discussions about, and some making decisions about when we come in, when we don't come in, and so on. But in general, we've tacked quite closely to the government's line, and also the university's policy as well.
Yeah. So that's wasn't something that caused division within among your colleagues.
No. I mean, we have tried to be as flexible as possible, and if people, you know, we have policies that sort of apply across the board. But if, you know, people, you know, can't sort of stick to those for good reasons, and it's within the sort of what's allowed by the university and the government, then we can usually accommodate it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think a lot of people found the whole lockdown business very hard, emotionally and psychologically. Do you think the fact that you had a specific project to work on that, as you said earlier, you thought would help, contributed to your own well-being?
Yeah, I mean, I think it did. Just because you've really got something to focus on. And of course, it's related to the thing you might otherwise be worried about. But I think it is possible to sort of detach slightly from that and focus on doing the work. And particularly at the beginning, as I mentioned, I really thought it was, you know, we could help. I mean, not of course not to the same extent as doctors and scientists working in other areas, but you know, in a small way, I thought we it would be useful to have this information, and that, you know, that's obviously motivating. Mm. I think it probably did overall help to have something like these projects to focus on.
Mm. Mm. Did you ever feel personally threatened by the virus? You did say, well, you talked about a worry about bits of society actually breaking.
Yeah, it sounds slightly silly to think about it like that now in hindsight, mm. but I certainly remember thinking that at the time. I was less, because I think even very early on, it was quite clear that this was a virus or a disease that really the risk profile for those in the older age groups was obviously much higher. And I think if you're, you know, sort of my age, then it was quite clear that it was less of a less serious for many people, younger people. So I personally wasn't worried about the virus for my own sake, but of course you worry about you know, your parents or the people you know and you interact with who perhaps have a greater risk for whatever reason. So that was a concern. And then I did, you know, you do wonder whether, for example, near the beginning, when you know, food started disappearing from the shelves in supermarkets, that was the sort of main concern that things would start to go wrong on that front. And you know, in the end, I don't think it was as bad as some people feared, but there was a brief time when it looked like it get very serious.
Okay, I think we've just about got there. I've just got a couple of final questions.
Yeah.
So has the work you've done on COVID raised new questions that you'd be interested in exploring in the future in relation to news consumption and trust and so on?
Yes. I mean, I think it will have a long-term effect. It's actually still too early for some of our projects to have picked up on this. But I think, you know, for example, with something like trust, it will have an effect on the sort of consumption side and the public side. On the you know, in different ways, it will certainly have an effect on what news organisations do, what journalists do. There's already been quite a big shift in sort of working practices. And the way sort of news organisations are run, that I don't think we are going to change back. And some of that can be positive. So you know, you can imagine, for example, how news organisations, if people are working remotely, journalists can be based outside of London more easily and sort of have a closer connection with the community that they're reporting on, and so on. So some of that could be positive. Then also, I think there's the issue of whether coronavirus has, and the pandemic has kind of accelerated some of the sort of declines that news organisations are struggling with. So the decline of print, for example, we saw that was very badly affected by lockdown for obvious reasons. But I think, you know, that could have broken habits for some people, and that there could be an acceleration of what was already declining. And then, you know, the debates around misinformation on social media, etc., are, I think, amplified by something like coronavirus because of the clear link between, you know, risks to people's health as a consequence. And that may have, when we look back, it may have been something that accelerated the move to more sort of content moderation, different policies from social networks, more action from governments to deal with it and so on.
Mm-hmm. And has the experience changed your attitude or approach to your work? And are there things you'd like to see change in the future?
I mean, it's made me think certainly more about, you know, what the right working environment is for different people, and how, you know, how it's wrong to just assume that everyone thinks the same about, you know, working from home or working from the office and so on. So I'd certainly think differently about that. I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Anything you'd like to see change in the future?
I hope, I suppose, just sort of building on that, that working practices, not just in academia, but everywhere, can become a bit more flexible to sort of meet people's different circumstances. And sort of thinking about the sort of news media, it's been different in different countries, but I think on the whole, in the UK, the way that vaccines in particular have been covered and reported on has been quite good. And, you know, I think that model the sort of seriousness that is attached to sort of vaccines, it would be nice if that approach could be applied to other topics as well. Because I think the news media and to a certain extent the government have been doing a good job. For example, the government dashboard, it took a while to arrive, but when it arrived, it was very useful. And I think, you know, that could you know sort of show how these similar, you know, how similar situations could be dealt with, and we learn something from it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I suppose again, climate change is the obvious example that people are now saying, you know, we've shown we can act collectively against one threat. Mm. We ought to be able to.
That's right.
Apply that attitude to another. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.